All right.
Is it safe to just close this breakout room thing, just the top right?
Yep. Hello, everyone. Okay. Welcome. I will greet the folks in the Cloud Zendo, and then those in the Dirt Zendo can introduce themselves. Start with Bob. Ryan.
Ryan.
Dennis.
Dennis.
Vin.
Vin.
Ellen.
Ellen.
Shoketsu.
Shoketsu.
Joshua.
Joshua.
Paulette.
Paulette.
Bruce.
Bruce.
Mark.
Mark.
Yashetsoki. Betty.
Betty.
Ruthann.
Ruthann.
And in the Dirt Zendo.
Katie.
Katie.
Warren.
Warren. Domio. All right. Oh, and also, is Christina leaving?
No.
What? Christina, who is one of our Cloud Zendo folks who's getting dirty today? yeah, all the way down from way north in Washington, right? 371 miles away. let's see, in terms of announcements, we had a lovely one-day retreat yesterday. Please consider setting aside Saturday, October 8th now, and making a priority to make that a retreat day. That would be the only other one that we have this year, and besides term student. And I plan to make it a longer retreat, so it'll start significantly earlier in the day and go later into the evening, and involve meals. So those of us who are in the Dirt Zendo will actually share some meals and probably do orioki. So we'll think also about how to incorporate those of you in the Cloud Zendo into that form. Perhaps you can assemble yourself an orioki set to participate. So more, stay tuned about that, and yeah, try to save the date. Also, a term student program is starting. So that is, I forget which day in September, there's the opening retreat, and then there's a closing retreat in November. So it'll be, and the intervening time is the time when if you sign up for that program, you have your own vows of practice to tie everything together. Maybe it has some to do with Sangha participation. Maybe it has some to do with something you're gonna study or a precept you're gonna concentrate on. It's really totally up to you what is appropriate for your life. And then all of the term students, there's usually about 8 to 12 people, get to know one another through the opening and closing retreats. And through, we had some really nice email check-ins during the last time we did this throughout the month. And people are aware of what your vows are, and you check in about how you're doing. So can it kind of increase your, some of us, but you know, find it increases our ability to keep our vows. but also just, it builds Sangha. So I highly recommend that if you can, the bare minimum is just the opening retreat and the closing retreat. There's a retreat that happens in the middle of one day, the October 8th one day retreat, which is recommended, but just the opening and closing retreats are required. Anything else I should announce, or any questions about any of that?
All right.
Right. Okay, so today, I wrote it in the newsletter, but also for the sake of the recording and posting, the small self doesn't have an agenda. The small self is our agenda. And actually, in this talk, I'm going to try to avoid using the term self a lot, but we can still leave that as the title, seeing as that's often how we talk about it. So in Zen, one of our main teachings is that understanding the true nature of self is of the utmost importance to living a life that is liberated, compassionate, generous, wise, skillful. And this isn't just like an intellectual understanding. Oh yes, okay. It's, you know, through our own direct experience, our self nature. Now, whenever we're employing the discriminating mind to figure things out, which, you know, whenever we use language and concepts, you know, a Dharma talk is inevitably just employing the discriminating mind, there are limitations. Our discriminating mind is for differentiation and identification, labeling, prediction, all of that. And reality defies accurate description. You know, our description is always just kind of an approximation that we use to get around. I like to say it's our mental map of reality, which it can be very helpful to have a map, right? But a map is not the actual terrain. So, but as long as we keep in mind not to mistake the map for reality, then it's useful to employ language. We call it like the finger pointing at the moon, right? So today, it's a lot of finger pointing at the moon. But I do think it's really, language has its limitations, but we can be more or less skillful with the use of language. So I think, you know, there can be terms that we use that encourage dualistic thinking or limited thinking, and there can be other ways that we use language that defy that a little bit. So what I'm going to do today is, first of all, I'm gonna talk about the basic definition of self, a classical just dictionary definition of self. And then I'm gonna parse out self into what I saw were like five different aspects of self, which all apply and maybe kind of overlap, but they're very different and they're of different levels of importance when it comes to our practice. So self is our central question. Self, no matter how noble or spiritual or mature or generous you are, self is of primary importance to you. It's of primary importance to all of us. It is, you know, this is the vehicle with which we live our lives and interact with the world. So, but that there's different things we're getting at when we employ the term self. So I'm just going to share the dictionary definition with you, not so much because I'm going to come up with my own definitions, but to remind us of like how we probably typically think about self. So there's four definitions here. A person or thing referred to with respect to complete individuality. A person's nature, character, for instance, like his better self. Personal interest. And then two philosophical definitions. The ego, that which knows, remembers, desires, suffers, etc., as contrasted with that which is known or remembered or da da da. And then the uniting principle as a soul underlying all subjective experience. And synonyms include individual, being, as in a being, identity, and personality. So, kind of leaving those behind, here are my five definitions of self. Once again, I meant to pull up my handy like visualization for you, but I had too many things to do between the end of Zazen and now, so I didn't pull it up. But I can probably type them into a chat if anybody wants to see it later. So one, and if you want to take notes, you can take notes. One is I'm calling individuality. So this is the fundamental unit of being. It can be differentiated from other beings and can't be broken down into any further component parts without the loss of life. You know, it's like here, sometimes, you know, in nature, there's a multi-celled organism, whatever, maybe the cells can go off by themselves, you know, but you can't take that cell apart without the loss of life. So like the individual, you define individual by this, what is the fundamental building block of this life? So in this sense, this aspect of self is a real tangible thing. It's manifested along, like what I say, the dependent dimension of reality, time and space and causality. And this fascinating reality of being an individual defines our whole life. We have a separate body. We move independently. We have unique perceptions. You know, the person standing next to us might perceive things differently. We have separate fortunes, good fortune, bad fortune. We're dependent, maybe intimately dependent on other beings and things, but also separate from them. And there's a way that is, as an individual, you're always alone in a certain sense. So I feel like this koan of individuality is something that really defines all of our spiritual traditions, much of our human culture. It's kind of a sense of wanting to return to connection, but always being like in our very nature to be separate. And that's good in a way, like that is what makes us who we are, but it's also a kind of spiritually painful position. We have unique characteristics and skills and tendencies. We have our own homes and relationships, livelihoods and experiences. And there's no escaping from this aspect of selfhood, and no need to. This is part of what it means to be human. Part of what it means to be any form of life that we know of. And Buddhism doesn't deny the reality of our individuality in any way. In fact, it requires us to embrace and be responsible for it. You know, that's really what the precepts are about, is how do we conduct ourselves as an individual? So that's the one aspect, very just so practical. And I feel like individuality, I'm using a different term than self. Self ends up being kind of muddied. All the things I'm talking about today, in some senses, we might just refer to with the word self, but then it's so many things that we're putting under that umbrella. And then also assuming that there is an inherently existing, enduring essence underneath it all. So parse it out a little bit. So that's our individuality. The second aspect is awareness. So as long as we are alive, we are aware in some way. And the scope or nature of that awareness will change depending on our conditions. Are we asleep? Are we awake? Are we, you know, are we ill? Are we healthy? Are, you know, what? But we're always aware of to some extent. And it could be that aliveness, being alive, is in some senses synonymous with being aware. We perceive things in the world around us. We perceive things within our own body and mind. And this is what makes it possible to respond and to navigate in the world. If we weren't aware, there would be no life. And if you think about it, it's not just the utility of awareness that matters. We need awareness to survive. But, you know, in a way, this is also the joy of life. So this is perhaps the closest aspect of our self to our true nature. In a way, this is like the simplest and purest way for us to think of ourselves. It's almost as if there's like a universal life force that manifests in and through our individuality. Although our true nature is, so we even though awareness is very simple and pure, our true nature, as I'll talk about at the end, is no self nature. So we shouldn't even equate it with our awareness. Like, our awareness is our true nature. Our true nature is like not identifying with any of these things as being, oh, that's me. But that said, our awareness, we can perceive over time, especially with practice, is like fundamentally no different than awareness as it manifests in any other being. Something really profound about that. And so this awareness is, I would say, our gateway to awakening to our true self nature. Now, the third aspect of ourself, getting into a very different kind of aspect of ourself, is our personal interest. So that's the one part of that, you know, standard definition that I borrowed. Personal interest. So fundamental to being an individual with awareness is a sense of personal interest. So this fundamental unit of life, naturally, it evolved with an instinct to preserve itself and to reproduce itself. If it hadn't, it would have died out a long time ago. So we have what in Buddhism we call our basic feelings: attraction, aversion, and indifference. And we also have instinctual responses to seek shelter and relationships and food and safety, comfort, status, avoidance of danger. So our personal interest arises for us constantly. This room is too cold or hot. This way of spending my time is worth it, or I should go do something else. I like people's admiration because it tells me I'm socially secure. Or I seek that possession or that experience because it's pleasant. For some deep-seated reason, I want sex or offspring or whatever. So these are very basic desires, very basic, you know, we like this, we don't like that, that thing makes no difference to us. So from the Buddhist point of view, our personal interest can be a motivating factor behind some of our problematic behaviors, but in and of itself, it's just what it is. It's very basic and uncomplicated. It manifests simply as attraction, aversion, or indifference. These things arise. It's unlikely that we can do that much about them. They just arise very immediately and naturally. It's only with the addition of the fourth aspect of self that we get into trouble. But it's also what gives us the capacity to practice. And that is what I'm calling being consciousness. So I didn't want to use the term self-consciousness, because once again, when we say self-consciousness, then, you know, oh, right, now we're conceiving of something called a self of which I am conscious. So trying to like not involve that word self, right? The self is more of just this composite of all these things. So this being some of the definitions, the fact of existence, but the fact of existing, substance or nature, something that exists, a living thing. So very specifically, we are conscious of being an individual who persists over time. So this, the time aspect of this is essential. So you can understand this more fully when you compare us with an animal. And, you know, animals, they may have more being consciousness than we appreciate. We don't know. We're not in their minds, right? And chances are, you know, there are animals with very little being consciousness and there are animals with more. For instance, crows. For instance, I was out on a hike and recently, and I got a good look at a pika. So this is a cute little animal closely related to a rabbit, but has little short ears, and it lives in rock piles. So in the mountains, high up at elevation, and there's these big rocky, you know, talus slopes, and there's lots of nooks and crannies, and these pika live in there, and they make this beep sound, and you hear it when you're hiking, but you rarely ever, you know, you look at the slope, you rarely ever see this little thing. But I got a good look at one, so I was thinking about the pika. So the pika, that one that I saw, it has individuality, it has awareness, and it has personal interest. You know, it's keeping a cautious eye out for predators. It creates a den. It's like, oh, that's good food to eat. Oh, that looks like something dangerous. Searches out sustenance. It has instinctual things that it does, like gather vegetation, and it stores the vegetation in its den for, you know, for later. So it has, you know, plenty of this personal interest. But it seems unlikely, and we don't know, but it seems unlikely the pika has being consciousness. It's kind of like a meta-awareness, awareness of not just things happening in the world right now and within, but awareness of being a being, of being an individual who persists through time. So the pika is probably not sitting there on its rock, reminiscing about yesterday when it ate some delicious, tender grass. It's probably not comparing itself to other pikas, brimming with pride about the amount of vegetation it has stashed away in its den. It's probably not thinking about tomorrow, hoping it doesn't get too hot. Apparently, they really don't do well above about 80 degrees. I mean, maybe it does. We don't know, but I think we can fairly judge that they're not, because their behavior is so simple. Once you get this being consciousness, a whole different level of stuff comes out, right? So that brings me to our last strongest and most problematic aspect of our sense of self. And that is our agenda. So our being consciousness allows our personal interest to be transformed into an agenda. From our basic feelings of attraction and aversion, our basic instinctual inclinations to survival and reproduction, we're able, like now that we're conscious of ourselves as a being who persists through time, you know, we can stop and kind of evaluate our, you know, status. How are things going? How safe am I? How well off am I? And, you know, what might happen in the future? And what can I do to improve, maintain, or at least improve my situation? So you can see why an agenda would be something advantageous to evolve. We're no longer limited just to our instinctual responses to things. We might, say, contemplate our situation and decide to store a lot more food for the winter, even if the weather's kind of nice now and it doesn't look like it's going to be a bad winter. We form complex societies, which increase our survival rate, but where relationships are tricky to navigate, where we need to imagine what other people are thinking and act accordingly, and, you know, kind of navigate, you know, make a plan for how to interact with people. And of course, we can, I mean, there's probably an unlimited list of things I could come up with here, like what is the result of having a being consciousness and forming an agenda? Well, one of the big things is we can innovate ways to improve our situation, right? We're not just stuck with like instinctual responses. We're like, you know what? If I built an even bigger house, you know, I would be like totally warm and safe. So, you know, thus all of the things that humanity has created. So we don't know why being consciousness evolved, but from the point of view of natural selection, it's, I think, really about us being able to have these agendas, being able to, you know, make more plans, to assess the past, to learn from the past. And, you know, so each individual has more, it's not just a matter of natural selection over the generations making a species more able to survive. It's each individual has the chance to learn and innovate and grow. But there are side effects of being consciousness, right? There is self-referential thinking, which is like that, this is our default mode, the psychologists call it now, when our mind is not otherwise occupied. We're just thinking self-referential thoughts. We're just thinking about what we might like to do, or we're analyzing the past, or we're just caught up in like this processing our own drama. Comparisons with others, ambition, fear and anxiety about the future, regrets about the past, an extremely complex and abstract sense of self. Now that we're invested in all of these things and relationships and beings, which are all part of our agenda, you know, we have our self is not just limited to like, oh, I got this body and, you know, I'm just responding to what's in my environment. Now we've got like our self agenda can span years. We get our sense of I, the one who thinks and decides and acts and experiences, and our sense of me as the one who is acted upon. That narrative we create, linking together, you know, this being consciousness that we understand we exist through time, and therefore it's kind of tied together with our memories. So this is where our problems arise and where we complicate our lives and experience dukkha. So dukkha is dissatisfactoriness, sometimes as acute as suffering, but it's not just pain. We might encounter pain or discomfort, mental, emotional, whatever. But that's, Buddhism never says you're going to be able to avoid that. That is just part of being alive. But when we think about it, that's not actually the worst part of being alive. That's not, you know, whatever. We deal with that. Sometimes we grow from it, whatever. We understand. You gotta, you know, you're going to feel a little pain in order to be able to love. You got to, it's, you know, it balances itself out. But dukkha is this, you know, twisted up, extra painful thing that we do to ourselves, which is basically a comparison of our current state or experience with what we think it should be, which is a level of abstraction only possible because of our being consciousness, which allows us to, you know, develop an agenda. If we had no, I sometimes think, you know, when it's really cold or really hot and there's all these wild animals out there and they're like, you know, birds just sitting there in the rain, just, you know, icy rain coming down on them, and just think like, you know, a human would be so miserable out there. They'd just be like, oh, this is so awful. And I just, you know, they're just, because they're not sitting there thinking it shouldn't be like this, I should have some shelter. Like, there's, they're not comparing it with anything else. But of course we do. So I'm thinking the pika does not feel dukkha about living a brief 7 years in a rock pile. It's not watching the eagles soar by and imagining, oh, what would it be like to see the rest of the world? It doesn't feel dukkha when the weather gets too hot. So we, of course, cause ourselves all kinds of dukkha as we reflect on the status of our lives. And we're capable of the most intricate kinds of comparisons and abstractions. It really is just amazing. We can cause ourselves dukkha, for example, by thinking back to a decision we made when we were, say, a teenager, that ended up having a significant impact on our life. And we can imagine what it might have happened if we had made a different decision, and we might conclude that the different decision would have put us in a better circumstance, and then we can feel dissatisfied with our current life because it's not that. I mean, that is complex. That is really abstract. The thing is that even though being consciousness, you know, allows us to have these agendas and brings this kind of problem, we also wouldn't be human without it, right? We wouldn't choose to be without our being consciousness. It's being consciousness is precisely what allows us to practice. It allows us to stop, evaluate our life, and think, maybe there are other ways that I could act or think or do that might lead to less dukkha, might lead to greater wisdom and compassion. I mean, we're employing our being consciousness and agenda in the same way, just, you know, in a different direction. So I would say being consciousness makes it possible for us to form an agenda, but it's not the same thing as an agenda. Thank goodness. So that's why I separated out, as I went through this, I actually separated out being consciousness, even though it probably evolved just to form an agenda. I don't feel like it has to. So the agenda is another thing. And I think often, I mean, that all of these different aspects of self are probably arising in us when we think of ourselves. But I think this last one, our agenda, is like often the most salient and the loudest and the most, the one that causes us to do the most, right? Whatever, that's the driving force. So often, that's why I said like the small self, meaning that sense of I, that sense of I and me that has an agenda, is the small self. It is nothing other than our agenda. It's not that there's a self over here as an enduring, independent essence. And it said, what should we do? And then forms that agenda. We're just experiencing an agenda. We're just looking out for ourselves, making a plan with this being consciousness. Therefore, our practice begins with disidentifying with our agenda. Ultimately, we need to recognize that all five of these aspects of self are empty of enduring, inherent self essence. They are real, but they're not graspable. They're not unchanging. They arise in context with everything else. So they're very real, but they're not what we think they are. There's no essence inside. There's no, as Robert Wright said, there's no CEO of all of this, right? So we need to recognize that for all of our aspects of self, but we really start with our agenda. That is the one that is the most salient and the most problematic. So, you know, how do we do that? You know, there's so many different aspects of our practice set up to encourage us to do this. And simply, you know, these words of fingers pointing at the moon, but they have an impact on us. Just to consider, you know, what does that mean that I am not my agenda? My agenda is not, it's just a part of me. If I let it get too out of control, if I'm too attached to it, it's going to cause me dissatisfaction, suffering. So even just kind of contemplating that thought, letting it work on you is part of the practice. But then we also, there's probably many more ways that we actually work on this, but in particular, our zazen is about sitting down and practicing letting go of our agenda. So just the physical act of sitting, of putting everything down, even if we sit there and our mind wanders all over the place, there is a level at which we have surrendered our agenda. We have at least temporarily, at least physically, put down all the stuff we're doing. Now, mentally, of course, as I well know, we can continue lots of work while we're sitting there on our agenda. But then the practice is when we notice we're doing that again. My favorite way to describe zazen lately is aim at the correct sitting posture with flesh and bones and leave everything to that. So it's really, we're not even trying to make our meditation any particular way. Because then it's very easy to take our spiritual practice and just add it to our agenda. Now I want to become a calmer person. Now I want to, you know, relieve my suffering. Now I want to be able to achieve deep, you know, meditative states. Now I want to, you know, and it's, we can actually, that's not the worst thing in the world, right? We can actually move along the path and, you know, make some progress, even if it's just part of our agenda, because it's healthy stuff we're doing, right? It is good, you know, mindfulness and sitting and all of this stuff is good stuff to do, even if we're kind of doing it for the wrong reasons. So that's fine. But ultimately we are, the real release from dukkha comes from, you know, surrendering our agenda entirely. And not permanently, right? You get up and you have your agenda, you navigate around your life, decide what you're going to do. But we can have a very different relationship to it. Rather than thinking of it as this I must do this, I want this, I need this, to think, aha, you know, my agenda is this. My mind is telling me, my mind and body and heart are telling me that I need to do this, I must have this. Isn't that interesting? It is not me. So, I guess I'll leave it there and invite comments and questions. Anyone in the Zendo, welcome to come up and sit in the questioner chair. Anyone on Zoom, feel free to, you know, electronically raise your hand or just, yes, Jay Soki. Nope, you're muted.
Thank you for your talk. Two things came up for me. One is, because of the pike example, an advocate for animals. In terms of what I've read and what I've actually experienced of animals displaying tremendous intelligence, empathy, courage. I saw one horse spend about 45 minutes trying to rescue another horse. Grief, ongoing grief. But I think the difference is when they're doing this, they don't think I am doing this. They have this call and this response to reach out. This other being, this other animal needs my support, needs my care. So anyway, I just want to put that out. I don't know where you'd put them in the self category, but I would say their agenda, if anything, is a deep inner response to an inner calling, maybe more coming from that place of stillness within, because it's not about themselves.
I really like that suggestion that those beautiful things, that grief and love and all of that could happen without that agenda. Like, that is that could be a really profound lesson there.
Share more time with animals.
Yeah.
Then my other is a question, or read about them too. You can there. In the last paragraph of your book on the Idiot's Guide, you and Hogan also talks about this. You say, you list, there's bullets of different things that you list, and you say, and one of the most important things of all of this practice, this is a paraphrase, not a quote, is that you discover and live your true inner calling. Do you recall that?
No, but
I think I took a photo of it, but I couldn't find it right now. But does it make sense? Because my next question is, for that responding to that deep inner calling, I'm not so sure if that's really an agenda. I'm asking you, in terms of all those selves that you listed, there might be an agenda to formulate the path, but I'm wondering if that really also comes not for most people, but for potentially from that deep inner listening. Or
it
could be imposed upon us. Very different.
I'm wondering because, like, to be honest, I just came up with this list of five over breakfast today, so I'm not like terribly attached. It does make me wonder whether it might want to be parsed out further and have a sixth one, which is really the one that we need to see through, which is, I guess, the best way to put it would be the CEO. That, because I do think, you know, it's possible we could have an agenda that has a negative connotation, but you know, our plan or something like that, that could be, like I said, that could be a very positive thing. That could be our practice. That could be, you know, we have this being consciousness, and now, you know, what do we want to do with this life energy? We get to actually consciously, you know, plan for the future, decide what we're going to do, aim at something. So in some ways, that agenda, again, if that's kind of negative, but our plan could be a very positive thing that doesn't necessarily have to involve what could be number six. It doesn't necessarily have to involve a belief that there is a I, that there is a CEO behind all of it, that there is someone at the controls, that we just basically we experience these other five things and we just assume there has to be one.
In a way that it's aligned with way seeking mind, but not way seeking mind in terms of Zen practice, but way seeking mind of expressing the uniqueness of your being. I don't know.
Christina.
Thank you. I have two reactions. One of them is I'm afraid we're all over evolved. A second one I came to me in this last discussion. I'm a little worried that I hide behind vocabulary. I mean, I know that using terms like CEO and agenda implies that I have a very strong sense of self, but then I'll use language like aspirational goal, kind of nice words, and I'm just a little concerned that it's the same control, it's just sweeter language that sounds more palatable, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about vocabulary, because I'm pretty sure I'm stuck in a very strong sense of self, and so I'd just love to hear about vocabulary in that.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I think vocabulary is very, very important, which is, you know, sometimes I think it would be just amazing if somehow, I don't even know if it's possible, but if somehow we're able to take on a practice of not using the word I or me, somehow saying what we had to say, communicating it without ever referring to that. It probably would, you know, shift the whole way that we understand what's going on. Because, you know, we're just so using language, like that's what I didn't want to call it self-consciousness, because it's like, yes, we humans are conscious of having a self, of being a self, and we just assume all of that. So, yeah, and I think with, that is the, our spiritual practice can become, or whatever positive things that we're trying to do in the world, they still inevitably have, I mean, they may not be selfish in the typical, you know, despicable sense, right? Like I was even thinking about that, like a motivation to serve, to improve the world, to do what looks or even is altruistic. We still, as long as we have that sense of, you know, the executive I behind it, I am doing this, there's still self-interest, if only so that we fulfill our aspirations, or that the world becomes a place that we feel it should be. So it could be quite subtle. There's still that sense of executive I, which maybe let's call that number six, is present until the last. It's very, very, it's very pervasive and subtle. So even when you know, we've been practicing for years and we're deep in meditation in the middle of a long session, and the mind has settled to a great extent, and we're, you know, there's a sense of spaciousness and all of that. Still sit. I feel so spacious. There's even a sense of like, I want to surrender myself completely. Just, it's like the I still wants, it wants that, it wants the liberation, it wants to let go, it wants the experience, it wants the unification with the great spirit, it wants, the I is still there. How do we let go of that? I just feel like sometimes it's felt like duct tape or something, like that's been stuck on you, and you're like, you're trying to get it off, and it just keeps on, whatever you do, it keeps sticking to it. But I do think, and I think in the Zen Living book, I think you talked about, it's not just a matter of like, either you have this sense of executive eye or you don't. It's possible to have less sense of self, for that self to become lighter. So I think that, you know, when I started practice, it was like, you know, that's that sense of self and my agenda and all of that was very loud and present and complicated and angst-ridden and all of this stuff. Now that kind of sense of I that is behind our deepest aspirations, it's much subtler. It's still there, and it's still something to see the emptiness of, but it's not, I like to think it's less problematic, right? It's less painful. Betty.
Thank you. Thanks for this talk. It's really interesting and brings up a lot of interesting questions. But to this point, I've been thinking about this from the beginning of the talk, about how things like being consciousness and agenda really drive things like innovation and growth and progress and development and all of that great stuff. Like, I mean, for me, that's undeniable that some of the things that come out of this are really positive. There's some bad stuff too, but you know, we have a lot of great things in our society right now because of people being conscious and having an agenda. So it sounds like what we're trying to do is find maybe some middle way to address that I part of driving the agenda for moving an agenda forward. But how hard to do that? Kind of like what you were just saying, it's like maybe the self is still there, and we kind of call it in a more subtle way to be a force behind these innovation and drive. And I don't know, I'm just having kind of struggling with the balance between embracing that and you kind of using it and pulling it in and just letting go, like really surrendering that relationship of self to my agenda. I don't know, just think about it some more.
Well, it makes me think about, you know, I've been exploring the concept of play and how when we're engaged in play, we could really, really playfully, we could be playing enthusiastically, we could be throwing 100% into our activity, trying to win. Right? I mean, it's not like, I'm not gonna caught up in that. I don't wanna win, right? But it's completely different because we're like, I wanna win, but I don't have myself invested in this, right? It's just play. And there's a way that the bodhisattva, who is, you know, we're talking about the being who's gonna be reborn countless times until every last being, not just human beings, but every being of every shape and form, every conceivable size, every way you can conceive of a being, they're gonna save them. So this is the ultimate agenda, right? But it says, as soon as the Bodhisattva thinks, I am going to save these beings, then like they have departed from the Bodhisattva path. So they're going to save all these people, but the minute they conceive of like, I am saved, and there's beings who are being saved. So they're taking that extra step. They're adding that assumption of inherently existing self in there, as if that is necessary. And the thought that that is not necessary, that we could be going about our lives, putting all of this effort in, being creative, innovative, altruistic, generous, whatever, without adding that I in there, is quite a challenge to our usual way of thinking, because we assume that is necessary. If I wasn't in charge, everything would fall apart. Anything else? All right. I will, yeah, Shay.
Couple things. I'm gonna bring in animals again, sorry. Instead of I had also a flash of an idea of calling it, instead of an executive I, an intuitive one, capital O-N-E. So there's no self in it, but it's your uniqueness that's bringing forth the action. So the Bodhisattva is in oneness, but is making this commitment in alignment with that oneness. Anyway, Then I was also thinking about animals again, is that when they are expressing altruism, it's just they see the other being in need. They're not saying, oh, I am doing this. So in a way, they're more Bodhisattvas than we are.
Yeah, that brings up that sense that when we awaken to our true self nature, which is a nature, it's just, it's not, it doesn't, like it said, if we didn't have any of these things that I listed today, we wouldn't be able to practice, we wouldn't be aware and alive. But none of them are our self. We can't, like, it's a heap of stuff, kind of like the skandhas, right? It's like, where is the self? But so when we realize that's not us, what does it mean to be alive? And that's when we recognize the boundarylessness. So in Jinryu's talk, she's mentioned that she liked the word boundarylessness more than boundless. Because again, boundless, you think like, yes, myself is boundless. Where when you think more like boundaryless, but the boundary is like the definition of a self. Like, what does it even mean to be a self that has no boundaries? But in that sense, everything is ourself. And then we respond, and I think this is why we don't need that completely illusory executive I. We don't need it. If we just practice and awaken to the truth, like, we will respond. We will respond appropriately. Our experience, our wisdom, our compassion, our sense of connection with beings, the response will come. So I really like that. Thanks for pointing that out. All right. Abiding in this ephemeral world, like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita.
Thank you. Thank you, Domeo. Thanks, Domeo.